I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's April 30th, 2007. 5 minutes to two. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, Senator Elton, Senator Dyson. With us today, we're going to work on two bills, Senate Bill 104, which is the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act, better known as the AGIA. We're going to have two presentations on that, one from Enbridge and one from ConocoPhillips. But initially, we were going to have Senate Bill 125, the PERS cost share bill, come up. We are going to, we're still waiting on a little bit of printing on that. So we're going to hear from Enbridge. They'll do their presentation, and then we'll have hopefully the 125 on, are at the committee, and then we'll continue on with ConocoPhillips. With that, I'd like Mr. Ron Britnell, Director, Alaska Gas Development from Enbridge. He can come forward. There's the. I'd also like to, before he starts, remind everybody to please turn off their cell phones and their Blackberries as they. Mr. Britnell, if you can please introduce yourself and who you represent for the record, and then continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Britnell. I'm Director of Gas Development for Enbridge, and I appreciate having the opportunity to come and speak to you today. My responsibility with Enbridge includes positioning the company to play a lead role in the development of an Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline project. A project which has been a high priority for our company for a number of years, and it's a high priority for our senior executives. Enbridge is a leading North American energy transportation company. We're a public company. Our stock is traded on both the New York Stock Exchange and the Toronto Stock Exchange. We supply a significant amount of the oil that's required in the lower 48, and we have pipeline businesses that take us all over the world. I've been to Juneau several times and testified before a number of committees, but this is the first time in front of Senate Finance, so I look forward to the opportunity. My hope is that this will be a dialogue, not a presentation. That's my preference. I think we can probably address a lot more of your questions and issues if we make it a dialogue. I'd like to start by first reiterating a message that my colleagues and myself have made several times over the last few years. North American supply-demand balance is very fragile. I know you all know that, but it's worth repeating again and again. If Alaska Gas is to find a market in North America, time is truly of the essence. We need the gas, but expediency is important. Real progress, not just the appearance of progress, has got to be gotta happen. We've been asked about the market window theory. If we believe that Alaska Gas will hit the market when and where it's needed. When we answer this, it's not so much about the timing of the market, but is it still going to be there? We are genuinely concerned about the fact that the market may be moving on, that it may be leaving Alaska Gas behind. We've seen market degradation due to supply issues, due to cost issues, due to price issues. We see coal plants being contemplated, and I know there are lots of environmental issues associated with coal, but the reality is demand and supply will match. If gas can't supply the demand, other sources of electricity will come into play. We'll also see LNG come on. With that, I'd like to switch to the next slide, if I can figure out how. Interprovincial Pipelines, the company that eventually became Enbridge, was founded in 1949. Today we are an international company, as I mentioned before, with interest in 50,000 miles of pipeline. We've been in business for over half a century, and we've grown steadily through both development and acquisition, and we operate at the highest levels in the business community. Enbridge owns and operates the world's longest liquid petroleum pipeline that runs from Canada down to the States. That blue line you see at the top of your map that stretches from Normanwell to Zama, that was the first pipeline built in permafrost in Canada. We put it there over 20 years ago, and it's been operating ever since. I heard a presentation the other day by a company that says they operate in cold weather. Well, we operate in the Arctic, and there's a big, big difference. Operating in permafrost and discontinuous permafrost, there's a lot of difference than operating in cold. No other pipeline in North America has the experience that we have operating in the north in North America. The red line that slashes from Fort St. John to Chicago is the Alliance Line. It's a gas pipeline that I'll talk about a little later on, but we think it has significance to the Alaska Line. The patch of yellow over to the right, that's our gas utility, Canada's largest. We provide gas to about 1.7 million customers. And yes, we're always looking for new supply. I've said on the record here many times that along with looking for an interest in the pipeline, Enbridge may be looking for Alaska to be a supply of gas. We may take a shipping commitment. Down south, you see some red gas transmission lines out of the Gulf of Mexico. We bring about half the gas that comes out of the Gulf onto Texas and onto other states. When I say deep, I'm talking really deep, thousands of feet. It's truly amazing and impressive what goes on at the bottom of the ocean. And finally, Mr. Chairman, that yellow patch at the top is Inuvik. With our partners, we own and operate the gas utility there. As you might expect, there's not a lot of customers, not a lot of gas, but we have learned a lot about supplying remote Arctic locations with natural gas through the Inuvik project. We hope someday to apply that learnings to here in Alaska. As I move on to the next slide, you can probably see at the bottom right-hand corner that we're included in the Global 100 Most Sustainable Corporations in the World for our performance on social, environmental, and governance issues. We take pride in being good corporate citizens. Now we just take pride in figuring out how to use the computer. There we go. And the resource owners, producers, and shippers that we deal with on a day-to-day basis continue to express their confidence in us. Just last Friday, we concluded a successful open season on an extension from metropolitan Chicago down to Cushing, Oklahoma. This is part of our $15 billion North American expansion, which we plan to complete over the next 5 to 10 years. Most of this growth is associated with the development in the Alberta tar sands, which I'll touch a little more on later on. These projects will give us unmatched current, and I emphasize the word current, experience in managing construction, labor, cross-border permitting, and large-scale North American pipeline projects. We're engaging contractors, recruiting and training workers, and yes, we have room for Alaskans. We keep hearing the fear that there's not going to be enough jobs for Alaskans. The reality is, Mr. Chairman, that we will take all the Alaskans that want to come across the border to be trained up to help build the pipeline projects the next 5 to 10 years. There just isn't enough people to help build these projects. So Enbridge is more than willing and able to bring Alaskans down to Canada and help them be part of our pipeline projects if they want the training. And there's been a lot of changes over the last 10 years in the pipeline industry. Changes in the market, the labor market is one of those things I just mentioned. Steel prices have really gone through the roof. And the other thing that's changed is who steps up to take capacity on pipelines. 5, 10 years ago, you would have seen a lot more marketing companies willing to do that. That all changed with Enron. So the dynamic of who steps up to take capacity on pipelines has changed over the last 5 to 10 years. I want to emphasize, Mr. Chairman, that in looking at these projects that we're doing right now, we are currently working with both the FERC, that's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and the NEB, the National Energy Board, on both sides of the border. We're working with all kinds of stakeholders, including environmental groups, Canadian First Nations, and lower 48 bands, Indian bands. And it's truly recent experience, knowledge and training, that's going to be available to the Alaska Line. Earlier I mentioned the Alliance Pipeline. I don't plan on going through a lot of detail, but I think it's an example of what the Alaskan pipeline we think probably will look like. Some might say might look like. We think ultimately it's a good example. The Alliance Line was developed by producers. It was built to free their stranded resources. It's a big inch, high pressure, liquids rich line. And just like we envisioned the Alaskan line to be, it was permitted using both the NEB process and the FERC process, and the whole thing took less than 24 months on both sides of the border. I said the producers built it, but the reality is before it went into service, all the producers left the project. Initially, there was about 22 owners of the Alliance line. Enbridge was one of them. We had about 11% initial ownership position. No other pipeline company did, but it was mostly producers. They stayed in the project long enough to be comfortable that it was going to move ahead, that it was going to be on time, on budget, and that the pipeline companies were going to take some balance and risk, and they negotiated a ship agreement that did that. Ultimately, by the time Alliance was built, there was no producers in the project. They had all left. And they were replaced predominantly by pipeline companies. And currently, the Alliance pipeline is owned 50% by us and 50% by an income trust. It was a great success story. And we think the Alaska line can be as well. No producers, no pipeline. Mr. Chairman, I've followed the bill through houses, both houses, and I've not heard any organization, and I strive, not any organization who has ever built a pipeline or operated one that refutes the statement. Some have said they want a five-party negotiation. Some have said we need physical stability. Some have put it in other terms, but the bottom line is no producer, no pipe, no project. If you legislate a process unworkable to the producers, it's our view that you put the project at risk because you're excluding the necessary participants, further delaying the project, and signaling to potential gas buyers Alaska is just not ready. I think you heard it last week from Fred Rich with Sullivan and Cromwell, rather, about financing the face of risk. We agree with the conclusion that the North Slope producers are the best positioned companies to assume the level of risk and make the shipping commitments. In fact, we think they might be the only companies capable of doing so, given their size and scope. Enbridge will not be submitting an application to NRGEA. We've been pretty upfront about that over the last few weeks, maybe the last few months. And until the producers are ready to commit to making a shipping commitment, which require resolution of the tax issues, we don't see how it moves things forward for anyone else to submit an application either. We anticipate ultimately being part of the project, as part of a consortium. So it's not by saying we're not going to make a submission to GEA that we're not interested. We're very interested. And as I said, my role is to get us into a pipeline project, to get us involved in Alaska, potentially as an equity owner, potentially as an operator, and potentially as a shipper. But we just don't see that happening right now without the uncertainty associated with the producers. We believe we can add value to the projects, but until the producers are on board and signaling a willingness to make shipping commitments that'll underpin the financing of the project, this project is simply too risky for a pipeline company like Enbridge to spend the hundreds of millions, and we emphasize hundreds of millions of dollars up front. It's not that we don't take risk, because we're building billions of dollars of projects now. We take risk. This one's in a whole new category. And I've got to tell you that the pipeline business is really a small group. I think you've seen that over the last few weeks. You don't see a lot of pipeline companies coming up and talking about the Alaska line, because there isn't that many pipeline companies in North America. And we go to the same conferences, the same dinners, the same hearings that they do. And we all ultimately hearing people talk about customers. Because in the end, that's what it's going to take to make this project go ahead. And we're going to need customers. And as I mentioned, the key customers here are the Alaskan gas producers. You may get utilities, and I'll talk a bit about that a little later on, but they aren't going to have the ability to be a significant contributor to the pipeline project. You're going to have the producers. Mr. Chairman, I think it's important for you to be aware of what's going on the market with respect to Alaskan gas as well. I mentioned the utilities. Potential buyers of Alaskan gas have been hearing for a long time that Alaska gas was getting ready, ramping up, and more recently, there was negotiations with producers. Then there was an election, and negotiations ended. Now the state has taken a different approach, which is your prerogative. But you need to be aware that it does create some uncertainty in the market about when Alaskan gas is going to arrive, or even if it's going to arrive. We believe the governor and her team deserve recognition for the priority they placed on the project. We believe they appreciate how important Alaska Gas is to North America. However, Enbridge is concerned that, as written, AGEA is unlikely to result in the movement of Alaska Gas. AGEA's focus seems to be 90% pipeline, 10% producer shipper. We think that's the reverse of what is needed. We believe that 90% of the focus should be on getting a shipper and 10% on the pipeline. Now, whether it's 90-10, 80-20, what we're really trying to say is the focus is wrong. The majority of the focus right now seems to be on the pipeline, not on the project. In order to get a project, you need shippers, which means you need to talk to producers. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to take the risk of talking legislation instead of pipelines, and for a pipeliner, trust me, this is going to be an interesting topic for me right now. But maybe it'll help make my point. Let's imagine that I come to your office and I say, I'd like to have a legislative hearing. You're going to say, well, do you have a bill number? And I'd say, well, no. And then someone might say to me, well, do you have any language you want me to look at? And I'd say, no. You'd probably tell me that before you grant me a hearing, I'd have to go and write up some language and send it to legal and then get it introduced. And if finally referred to committee, you might have a hearing. As pipeline developers, builders, and operators, this is the way AGEA looks to us. Without shippers, there's no bill. Someone has to agree to ship the gas. You can spend the time, and I know this legislature has spent a lot of time, and beyond, and I got to tell you, I give you guys recognition. The time and effort you're putting into this is commendable. So it's not that people aren't noticing. It's commendable. But in the end, we believe you need a shipper. The goal is to move the gas, not just to get a pipeline. It can't be about a pipeline. It has to be about a project. One final comment while I'm on this slide, Mr. Chairman. Enbridge believes that AGEA adds unnecessary regulatory complexity, especially with respect to rolled-in rates. The potential for rates to go up is not only a negative for the North Slope producers, and I know you've heard that over and over again, but it's also a negative for any utilities like Enbridge's. I'm going to take a second and maybe walk you through why that is. It is very difficult to get regulatory people to give us permission to take any long-term contracts, period, these days. And we're not unique in that. All of the lower 48 utilities face the same thing. It's a difficult task to get the local regulatory bodies to give you the ability to take a long-term commitment, to take a long-term supply. Part of that, just as a history I talked about before, 5-10 years ago, the utilities bowed out, the marketers stepped in, the NRN stepped in, and the regulators got used to the fact that utilities didn't have to take long-term contracts. With the demise of the marketers, some were coming back, but generally the demise of the marketers, the utilities are now trying to, once again, look at being able to take long-term contracts, but the regulators are pushing back. Enbridge has spent a fair bit of time over the last couple of years in dialogue with NARUC, the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, the IOGCC, and others, to try and do an educational process with some of the regulators to let those utilities take long-term commitments, for example, on Alaska Pipeline, but it's an uphill battle. It's even more uphill when you have to go to your regulator and say, I'm going to make a commitment and I'm agreeing to pay X, oh, by the way, in 15 years from now, it might be X plus 15%. So it's not just the producers who are going to have trouble with this, it's other shippers as well. Specifically, we're concerned about section 4390.130 on page 3 of the bill, which is entitled Application Requirements. We think the state will end up further ahead by clearly stating what it is they want and then allowing the best companies in the world to propose the best way to get there. The way we read the current language, we see a command and control arrangement where companies cannot leverage their experience to the state's advantage, even if they apply it at all. We don't understand why Alaska would want to create a process that might stymie innovation and result in the best project not moving forward, or more concerning, result in no project moving forward. And why you as members of the Senate, why would you not want the opportunity to see a proposal that doesn't check all the boxes, but potentially could offer more significant value to the state? Because it's our understanding that might be the case right now. If you don't tick all the boxes, you may not see that one proposal or those two proposals. There are people out there, and I know the legislature has hired a bunch of them, who can help you sort out what works and what doesn't. They are very educated, highly skilled, experienced, intelligent people who consult with governments to help them make the choices that are in their best interest. We believe it's absolutely possible to fairly judge dissimilar proposals. I know it's more difficult, but it's absolutely possible. We're not sure what the bill drafters are afraid of here, and why they insist on a potential developer meeting all the requirements or not show up. Part of what a pipeline developer does, like myself, is make pitches to potential shippers. We go up there and we compete head-to-head with other developers. We try and come up with creative solutions. And then at the end of the day, we hope that our solution gets picked. We go head-to-head all the time. And every time that Enbridge develops some idea, chances are there's another pipeline company in North America or abroad that's trying to do something similar. And what we do well is try and come up with creative solutions. We work with our shippers, or hopefully our shippers, try and come up with win-win solutions. And it doesn't always mean that we always get everything we want, but that's the whole idea of developing new pipes, is to come up with win-win solutions. And you have to have some flexibility as well. You've got to realize that what you've negotiated today may not ultimately be what ends up being the best project in the long term or the ultimate solution. So if you're open-minded enough to have some flexibility as you go along, then you'll get something moving. We acknowledge that it's common practice in government for an RFP process to be pretty specific, which facilitates an easier apples-to-apples comparison. But as you've heard over and over, this is not a standard project. This project is unique in many, many ways. The sheer scope is just one of them. We believe the government is going to have to assume a non-traditional role here and engage in non-traditional processes in order for this to work. We insist on using the same process that you use for, and the same level of specificity, if I can ever say it, specificity, can't say it. If you continue to ask to be the same amount of specific in your desires you use for paperclips, desk chairs, or patrol cars, we believe you'll fail in getting a real project. I mentioned earlier that if moving the resource, I mentioned earlier though that if moving the resource is commercially viable, investment dollars will flow in Alaska. That very thing is happening right now in Enbridge's own backyard, and it's called the Canadian Oil Sands. We believe that if you have to look at the gas pipeline as just the first stage of developing a bigger project, just like they did in Alberta. You've got tremendous potential here. You've got 35 TCF, but that's still 20 TCF short of a pipeline. But indications are there's much, much more. I mean, if you look at the sheer potential of gas side rates, it's staggering. But it's not possible to tap into that without a pipeline. Alberta recognized the potential of its oil sands when it started negotiating with its producers. And at the time, they didn't come up with the ultimate solution, but they showed they were willing to be flexible, come up with innovative solutions, and right now we're looking at $125 billion in investment. I think that's something like four times the permitted fund. Did the original people that negotiated those deals think they might have $125 billion in investment? I doubt it. I wasn't there, but I doubt it. But what happened was that they got the snowball rolling. And we think the same thing can happen here in Alaska. Don't look to get the ultimate solution first. Get the snowball rolling, and it will keep rolling. Well, it might seem reasonable to assume that producers will show up and eventually, ship or be enticed to ship, and I use the words enticed, to provide their gas. We think this is a very risky assumption, even with the cost sharing. I know a lot of concerns been expressed here about the need to have certainty. We're down the pipeline. The reality is, in our experience, there is no absolutes. You're not going to get an unconditional commitment for this project to proceed. I know that's what you would like to have happen as Alaskans. The reality is there's just too many uncertainties with any pipeline project, let alone this one. I mean, this one's so unique in its size and scope, but any pipeline project, we never get an absolute unconditional commitment either by the developer or by the shippers. You never know what might happen in terms of the regulatory outcome, you know, what the FERC might place as stipulations or the NEB. You never know what's going to happen in the marketplace or to the labor market, the steel market, between the time you've made your application and it comes out the other end. So the reality is you will get no absolute guarantee from anyone, at least that's our view, to move the project forward and make it happen. It's just not what happens in the real pipeline world. Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to take my time on this one, but just very briefly, I want to be clear, no company, and I stress, no company has the exclusive rights to build a pipeline in Canada. I know there's been some discussion around that. The reality is there is nothing in the NEB, the National Energy Board Act, there is nothing in the NPA, the Northern Pipeline Act, that says there is exclusive rights to build a pipeline to move Alaskan gas in Canada. Yes, there are certain things that one party has, and they're entitled to those things, but that is different than saying they have the exclusive rights to move Alaskan gas. I'm willing and able to go into more specifics on this, but we've also developed a paper, Mr. Chairman, if it might be easier just to make the paper available on our views on this, we can do that as well.
Okay.
I think it's important to realize that it's a good thing that no one has exclusive rights to build it in Canada, because if they did, then you would end up having a competition in which you were just competing for the rights to build it in Alaska, a pipeline in Alaska to move Alaskan gas and through down to the States, because we believe the only viable way to make a project go is through down through Canada. So now you're going to have a competition just to build a pipeline in Alaska and ultimately not have that same level of competition and creativity in the Canadian side. Fortunately, as I said, you do have that ability because there is no exclusive rights. And we believe the Canadian government understands the value of that cooperative but also competitive approach. We were encouraged last May by the words of our federal minister, Jim Prentice, who is the Minister of Indian Affairs and Northern Development, but he's also got the Alaska Pipeline, Mackenzie Gas Pipeline portfolio. Minister Prentice was speaking at a dinner of pipeline companies, and his key emphasis was that we'll let the market decide. It's that whole competitive thing that I was just talking about. Second, he stressed the importance of a modern regulatory regime, which doesn't sound like a 30-year-old regime. He wants a project management approach. What does that mean? It's no different than what we're trying to achieve here. It's a step-by-step process in which we go through each of the gates and make sure that this project makes sense. Fourth, the pipeline must support Aboriginal development, which we think is just basic sense. A few years ago, some of the Yukon First Nations approached us and asked about pipelines, and we were happy to tell them a little more. We actually, in fact, put on a pipeline 101 session in the Yukon just to give them the basics, because it's important that First Nations in Canada, and I think it's no different than others here in Alaska, and not just necessarily First Nations, who haven't seen pipelines before, but give them the basic fundamentals of how do you build it, what's it going to do to the environment. So we've been starting to do that. And in fact, so has members of the Yukon government, the federal government, the BC government. Even recently, a couple weeks ago, we participated in a session at Yukon, which various levels of government and pipeline companies continue this dialogue with First Nations on how do you build pipelines, what's it going to look like. And during that session, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency once again talked about fact there are options in Canada, whether it be the NPA process or the NED process. And then finally, Mr. Prentice talked about the need for benefits on the Canadian side. And I know that in other committees that I testified to, this has put up some alarm bells. What do you mean by benefits? The reality is what the Canadian government's looking for is that the costs can't outweigh the benefits. There has to be benefits on the Canadian side too. Well, we've got to build roads, we've got to build bridges. There has to be something beneficial to Canadians, just like they want to be beneficial to Alaskans in the lower 48. Some final thoughts. We believe that the outstanding physical issues, the tax issues, are really the elephant in the room here. You know, I mentioned it earlier. The reality is, until the state can deal with that issue with the producers, we don't see a whole lot of progression, a real progression on the project. I mentioned that we don't, as much as it might be desirable, we don't see the ability to have an unconditional commitment to move the project forward. Importantly, we think that you'd be best served as Alaskans if the process you put in place allows for creativity. That you don't just create a process that's all about process. That you don't allow for proposals that don't tick all the boxes, that don't necessarily meet all the things that you want met, but could provide value in different ways. We think it's important that you, as members of the Senate, be able to see that, and that you're smart people, be able to evaluate that. We don't think the government financial assistance in the G is essential, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't leave it there. I mean, if the government feels that it could be of value to someone, then leave it there, but we don't think it's essential to move the project forward. And we don't think that you need to add additional regulatory complexity to the process. As I mentioned before, adding that extra layer of regulatory complexity around the 15% and some of the other issues just makes it that much more difficult to get shippers, not just the producers, but other potential shippers. And I can't tell you that there's going to be a lot of other shippers. It'll be a challenge, but there might be. But you don't want to create a process that makes it even more difficult for those potential shippers. And then finally, Canada's going to be ready. I know there's fear and probably some fear-mongering that Canada won't be ready. The reality is Canada knows how important this project is. We've met with various members of the government. They know this is an important project. Canada's getting ready. That's one of the reasons why they're out talking to First Nations, and there are committees made up of the Alberta, BC, and Yukon working together along with the feds. And they're going to be ready. And they'll be ready for one of two processes. That's it, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time. I'm open to questions.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Brunel. One of the things that we're trying to work on as we work through this bill is go through and look at solutions. And one of the final comments I thought I heard you make was Enbridge isn't interested or doesn't think the $500 million equity infusion or cash infusion or however you want to word it up front is necessary to move the project forward. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, would it be nice to have someone else's money? Of course, it's always nice to have someone else's money, but but usually that comes with attachments, and AGIA certainly has attachments with the $500 million. And so it's a function of do the requirements and the tick-the-box stuff I was talking about, you know, that you might have to meet right now, are they worth the $500 million? We don't think they are. We don't think that we would necessarily need the $500 million. If the state wants to inject that money in the project to try and move it forward, they're certainly able to do so, but we just don't think it's necessary.
There's a requirement in there that if there's failed open seasons, you go through those and go on to try to acquire a FERC certificate, with the state contributing 80% and the entity with the license contributing 20. What's your firm's opinion on on that particular issue?
Probably a little biased, Mr. Chairman, because I don't think we would ever get ourselves, we wouldn't get ourselves in the position where we'd have to go for it, because we wouldn't apply up front without knowing where the producers were at. But let me take it on, irregardless of that comment. The reality is, in order to get to a FERC certificate, and it's not just a FERC certificate, we're talking about a FERC and NEB certificate. There's no sense getting one if you don't get the other. You're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. I know that in previous committees, tens of millions have been tossed out, and then hundreds of millions have been tossed out. In order to get to the level of specificity, to get as detailed as we need to on the open season, to get the details that would be required to get the producers and other shippers to stand up, we believe you have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. Otherwise, you're not going to get into a binding open season. You might get into a non-binding open season for tens of millions, but it's going to take hundreds of millions for a binding open season. So we couldn't see ourselves even spending the hundreds of millions of dollars to get to the open season beforehand, not knowing the answer. That's not typically what we do. Typically, in a pipeline project of which we're involved in, we will go out and talk to our shippers, and they're not always producers, but there's two types of pipelines. There's producer push, supply push, and there's a market pull. This is actually, we believe, kind of a combination of both. We think there'll be a supply push to the liquidity area, probably Alberta. You may see then more market pull from Alberta, where the utilities might come to Alberta and grab it from there. The reality, though, is that we will know up front, or typically would know up front, who those shippers are, whether they're going to sign up or not. So we would have had all that dialogue up front before we had the open season. And we would have done that by having discussions and having dialogue and not getting to the open season. The reality is, if you have an open season in which you're not successful, it's job limiting, it's career limiting. You should never get there. You should always know up front that you're going to have a successful open season. Typically, what open seasons do is top it up. You've known beforehand that you might be 70% of the way there, 80% of the way there, but you're not all the way there. And so you go to the open season to see if you can top it up. And the way that GEA seems to be setting itself up right now, you might be going there not knowing at all who's going to show up. So we couldn't see ourselves getting to the point where we'd have to go to the FERC certificate, because we couldn't see ourselves getting to an open season in the first place not knowing if the shippers were there.
So then am I to infer that you will not be an applicant for the AGEA license?
Enbridge will not be an applicant for an AGEA license as currently crafted on our own. Yeah, we have always said that we would hope to participate in a consortium, because we think it's going to take a consortium to get it built. We've always said that consortium, as far as we're concerned, has to include the producers, because they're the ones that take the risk. And so we would not apply as Enbridge. If ultimately AGEA had enough changes in it where the producers could see their way to potentially making an application, we think we create enough value that we'll become part of the consortium. But as Enbridge is Enbridge, no.
Could you bring forward to the committee the sections of the bill that are troublesome to your company and solutions? Because it's easy to tear it apart. It's much harder to build things. And then possibly come forward with the committee on areas within AGEA that you like. So we have specific sections of the bill that we can look at that your firm feels that are problematic, and also areas of the bill that your firm feels are not problematic that are very positive.
We can certainly do that, Mr. Chairman. I'm somewhat reticent to get into a lot of detail, because, like I said, we don't think as a corporation that the G is necessary. I understand that it will happen. I think we're of the view that something will come out the other end. I can tell you right now, and I'll refer to it as I referred to earlier, one of the ones that we have the biggest issue with is the, and I forget the exact section, but it's the section that says that thou shalt tick this, 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 and this, or don't show up. And I think that's, I can...
Section 130.
Yes, thank you. Because we think that creates a situation where you, as members of the government, may not have the opportunity to see the most creative solution, and the one that may, in fact, add more value. There may be reasons why someone doesn't like box number three, but could add value in a whole bunch of different ways. And our understanding right now is it's currently drafted, and GEA wouldn't even allow that applicant to show up, or if they did show up, it wouldn't see the light of day. And so we think that's a mistake.
You have questions? Senator Huggins.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron, on your slide 12, next to the last bullet says, Canada will be ready for this project, but claims of exclusivity will be denied. What does that mean?
Well, I think what that's really going to, the point I was making earlier, there is no exclusive right to build a pipeline in Canada. I mean, that's probably a poor choice of words in the last part, but really what it's coming down to is Canada's going to be ready, whether it's under the Northern Pipeline Act or whether it's under the NEBC Act, and that'll be decided by the shippers in the market.
I understand. I got it. Good. Thank you, Mr.
We're going to take a brief at ease while I drop this slide projector down, and then so just sit tight. We'll just be about a minute. Come back to order. It's just difficult for me to see the hand signals when the committee members want to ask questions. But I know once we go to at ease, some of them wander off fairly quickly. Could you, and on slide number five, you talked about the project being too risky, too big, and too complex, and too expensive to move forward without producers. Could you elaborate on that, and how much of the project could be financed possibly by the downstream market pulling, as you referred to it?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to. Financed, I guess, is an interesting question. How much could the downstream community step up? Potentially, I think you might see hundreds of millions, and I say potentially, commitment, maybe half a B. The reason I say that is that we have had dialogue with some utilities in the past, and these discussions go back probably 3 years now, in terms of what the interest might be. So something in that kind of neighborhood might be possible. Once again, it depends upon what their regulators will let them do, and that's the challenge. Is even utilities need new supply; they're hurting for new supply of gas. The tricky part for a utility like ours and other utilities is then going out and being able to make the commitment to long-term commitment to be able to get that supply. And in this case, it's a very long-term commitment. For example, $200 million a day. For example. Commitment just for the transport, not the gas, just for the transport, is billions of dollars. And so that's a big thing for a regulator to bite off, because in the end, it's not the owners that are necessarily going to bear the risk, it's moms and dads. The utilities will step up with supply for their customers, but they're doing it for the moms and dads. And if they're wrong, it's the moms and dads that have to pay more.
So when you say it's half a billion cubic feet a day, how big of a capacity are you talking about in gross? So there's a reference point at home.
I'm thinking about a pipeline about 4.5 BCF a day, that kind of scope, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
So that would still leave.
You're still talking about the lion's share for the producers to step up for. We can't envision that you would see the utilities or others being able to fundamentally underpin the project. I talked about the open season process where you get some top up. I think you might see utilities being able to top up. But even then, the tricky part is they'll have to be able to acquire not only the transport, but the supply. So they have to know what the supply contract looks like. They're not going to be able to just step up and take a transport contract without knowing what their gas supply contract also looks like.
You mentioned that your firm is not 100% supportive of the requirement for rolled-in rates, which we have a presumption at FERC for rolled-in rates. My understanding is Canada has rolled-in rates is the general mode of operation. Why wouldn't Enbridge be supportive of the rolled-in rate requirement, being a midstream company?
Good question, Mr. Chairman. The reality is the three most recent pipelines that were built in Canada that are cross-border, so the Alliance Pipeline, which we have ownership in, the Vector Pipeline, which goes from Chicago to Dawn, Ontario, so the southern part, just call it Windsor, call it Detroit, so the other side of the, and the Maritimes and Northeast Pipeline, which brings offshore eastern Canadian gas down to Boston. They were all negotiated rates. So when they were built, the shippers negotiated with the pipeline companies, and they have fixed tariffs, or they have tariffs that move, but there isn't a presumption of rolled in. So while it is true that a significant component of the gas that's flowing through Canada right now is on rolled in rates through the Trans-Canada system, that isn't necessarily indicative of what's happened recently.
The gas treatment plant. There's been some discussion of how we deal with that. Clearly, we have to have a gas treatment plant for the line to become usable. Does Enbridge have a position on the gas treatment plant?
I assume, Mr. Chairman, you're talking about where the gas treatment plant, you said a position on where the gas treatment plant should be. Would that be the underlying assumption or question?
Yeah, and who is Enbridge interested in building and owning that if they do apply for the AGIA license? Do you want it included or excluded?
We certainly do, Mr. Chairman, we certainly do gas processing. A good chunk of what we do in the lower 48 in the Texas includes gas processing facilities where we take some risk on the liquid. So if the opportunity presented itself, yeah, we'd be interested in looking at that. In terms of where that plant should be, I know there's been a lot of discussion around the fact that it would be good to have the liquid stay here in Alaska to create a petrochemical complex and new industry. That's a laudable goal. You're certainly entitled to try and pursue that. We think that the reality is you're a long ways from market here in Alaska for those petrochemical products. There is available capacity currently in Alberta to be able to process some of those liquids. You might find that as the resource owners, because the state certainly is a resource owner, that your ability to create greater wealth for the liquids might be in getting them to go to Alberta and getting somebody to pay you for them rather than trying to create new facilities here. The other thing about the midstream business, the extraction business, it's highly volatile. While things look rosy today, they have not looked so rosy even as close as 5 years ago. The gas prices are volatile and oil prices are volatile, which means that you get lots of volatility in the NGL business. So it's not what you call a certain business by any stretch of the imagination.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron, the issue is producer-owned pipelines or part ownership. As I recall, you, in describing the Alliance Pipeline, that you portrayed it, the producers were initially part ownership. You had 11% relatively early on. At some point, they divested themselves. Is that accurate?
That's correct, yeah. If you'd like, Senator Huggins, I can sort of walk you through.
Please, the history, please.
Mr. Chair, what started out is that the concept of Alliance was essentially a producer's concept. They desired more competition for moving their gas in Canada, and so a bunch of them got together, several pipe or producers, I think there might have been 20 of them at one point, got together and came up with the concept of the Alliance Pipeline to create competition to move Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin gas to Chicago. They then moved that concept along, and Enbridge joined the process as the only pipeline initially, and 11% was the number we had initially. The design was moved forward, the tariffs were moved forward, and the open season happened. The producers stepped up, as did others. Enbridge Utility took some capacity on Alliance. And as the project firmed up, the producers realized that they didn't need to be part of the pipeline to get what they wanted. What they wanted was the pipeline to move forward. They wanted to know, they wanted to have some certainty around tolls and tariffs. They wanted to have some certainty that it was going to go ahead. And once that happened, by the time the pipeline was actually constructed and went into operation, they were all gone. And they were all replaced by other pipeline companies that hadn't been in there.
Follow-up, Senator Huggins?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ron, in the case of debt-equity ratios, what sort of boundaries is your experience with debt-equity ratios? In Aegea 70-30, I just tell you that we've heard from some 80-20, 75-25, but your experience at Enbridge, what is the boundaries in debt-equity?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Huggins, Alliance is 70-30. So 70-30 is certainly achievable. I believe, and this is not our pipeline, but it's a pipeline company I was associated with before. The Maritimes Northeast, is 75-25. So could 80-20 be achievable? It might well be achievable. It would be going somewhere where we haven't done before, but I think it might be achievable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the presentation. I'm back on slide five, and as you were making your presentation, I wrote something down that I think I understood you to say, and I want to make sure that I did understand you to say that. At that point in time, you said that Enbridge is not going to submit an application, and I'm assuming that means either as Aegea is presently constructed or if changes are made in Aegea. Did I misunderstand what you said?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, no, you didn't. I mean, we can't see Enbridge make submission solely as Enbridge. We think that the project will ultimately have to, as I mentioned before, ultimately have to include the participation of the producers, at least initially as equity owners. Don't know if it'll turn out to be Alliance-like, but at least initially as equity owners. So we can't see ourselves making a submission either under the current Aegea or a modified Aegea solely as Enbridge. If there were changes that made Aegea palatable to the producers, could we envision ourselves potentially making a submission or some modified submission as part of a consortium? Yes, if the producers let us in, and we certainly hope they will, because we think we can add some value.
So if I can follow up. So I don't want to, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So is it fair for me to conclude from that the best possibility of Enbridge participation is if it's a producer pipeline and not if it's a pipeline that is built by another pipeline company?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, I think that's a fair characterization, but let me put it in my own words. We don't see a project going forward that doesn't include the producers, because we don't see that any company will be able to make a pipeline project go forward without the participation of the producers. The producers are the ones that are going to have to take the lion's share of the risk in terms of cost, in terms of everything, and all the other risks associated with the pipeline project. So if you're asking me, would you see Enbridge join up with ABC Pipeline Company and XYZ Pipeline Company to make a submission, the short answer is no.
Senator Elton, go ahead.
And again, I'm somewhat struggling. Mm-hmm. I'm somewhat struggling with this, as you can tell. So essentially, your testimony. Let me first clarify something. You're defining participation of a producer as something beyond FTC. you're assuming that, or I'm assuming when I hear you testify, that you're talking about participation of a producer as an equity stakeholder in the pipeline, not just simply FT.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, yes. And the reason I say that is because in the many years, and it's been several years since we've been talking to producers about this project, we hear them talking about the fact they want to be part of it because of the fact they're going to bear the risk as equity owners. So they're saying that that if we're going to be bearing the risk as shippers, then they want to have control as equity owners. We understand that. And that was kind of the premise of the Alliance Pipeline, is that those producers who were going to be shippers said, this is new, this is different, therefore we want to have something to say about how it's developed, at least initially. We think that's fair here in terms of the Alaska project, considering it's on a whole different scale from Alliance. Do we think ultimately the producers might leave? They might. Don't know. But they might. But we can understand why they would want to be equity owners initially, to be in control. Or and it doesn't mean they can't have other partners, but I can see why they want to be at the table and see what's going on in the development of the project, because, as I mentioned before, they're the ones that are going to bear the biggest risk. There just isn't the ability for utilities and others to step up substantially enough to make this project go forward.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Britnell, is that correct?
That's correct.
You indicated one of your first statements was that your concern is that the market may be moving on. Do you have a kind of a time frame that you believe that might be happening within that might be help us a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thomas, if I did, I'd be trading, and I'm not. But the reality is some of that market's moved on already. In terms of some of the fertilizer plants, some other things. The power plants were moving on. I think that some of the environmental issues that are coming to the forefront will slow some of that down. But you and I and the rest of the North America haven't slowed our hunger for power, for electricity. So it's going to happen yet somewhere. You know, LNG may fill the gap, but it's not the panacea right now either. I mean, I think 2 or 3 years ago, the fear was Alaska Gas has to get moving because LNG is going to eat its lunch. The reality is LNG is not moving that fast either, because they're facing the same hurdles, the cost and labor and a whole bunch of other things, including foreign control. So if it isn't LNG, it's going to have to be something else, and it may well be coal.
Senator Thomas, follow up.
This is just a little different subject. The Alliance Pipeline, what is the capacity of it and the volume now? Is it full, so it would not be able to receive any of this gas for further transmission?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thomas, the Alliance Pipeline is fully contracted and full till 2015. And so no one, at least we don't anticipate seeing Alaska Gas till well after 2015. So Alliance would be available to move Alaskan gas. We continue to see drop-offs in production in Alberta. So there certainly will be capacity to move it. It's also expandable fairly cheaply. So it will have the ability to move Alaskan gas and to be expanded when the time comes. Hopefully, when the time comes.
Thank you.
Okay. I think the dollar size of the Alliance Pipeline, what magnitude of project was that?
I think I should know this off the top of my head, sorry, Mr. Chair. About $5 billion.
Is that Canadian or U.S.?
That would be U.S.
Okay. And
as I say that, I'll probably miss it by $400,000.
So Enbridge is capable of constructing a gas line of this magnitude. Is that correct? All else being equal.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask for a clarification, when you say construct, does construct mean do we have the capability to see it from A to B to construction, or are we talking about the financial capability to build it?
If you had FT commitments to construct or to go forward to a FERC certificate, does Enbridge have the ability to build a line? We've had some testimony that you know, particular individuals or companies feel they're the only ones in the world that can build it. And
Mr. Chair, we would have the ability. We don't have, to be honest, we don't have the desire to build it all. The project is too big. Our market cap's about $15 billion U.S. This would be a bet the farm project if we were the sole owner. We envision being a 10 to 20% equity owner. That would be our sweet spot.
Okay, thank you. Senator Thomas.
Just a couple others. One of your unnumbered pages shows proposed pipeline development.
Mm-hmm.
And you show Kitimat gas, or not sure which it is, gas or oil. Just says potential projects. Or is that gas to Central California, it looks like, or someplace on the West Coast?
Oh, that, no, sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Thomas, that is an oil line. We proposed our Gateway project to move gas from, or sorry, oil from the oil sands to offshore British Columbia. Some of that would go to Asian markets and some would be shipped down to California.
And would Alaskan gas potentially be used to assist in your tar sands or whatever project?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thomas, the Alberta tar sands certainly has a growing need for more gas to produce more oil. That's an absolute. But they're also conscious of the fact that there's uncertainty around gas supply, including whether gas is going to show up from Alaska. So those same producers are looking for alternatives to try and produce the oil. But yeah, there's a growing need for Alaskan gas and other supplies for the Alberta tar sands.
And one
final.
What was the time frame on your next slide? It shows the preliminary submission December 31 and 96 on the Alliance Pipeline, and the certificate was basically 2 years, later, I guess. What was the overall time frame from, I'm sure it was a concept for quite some time, but before it was a serious concept until the end of construction? Do you know that time frame?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thomas, I don't off the top of my head. I'll get that information for you. I should. I apologize.
But you said the construction was about a two-year project.
Yeah, so it depends on how you define serious. That's
I
what.
Understand. I understand.
But I will get that to you before I leave.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brunel, for coming here to Juneau to testify on AGEA, and if you could try to expedite the response back on positive aspects of the bill and specific areas of where and how and even language that you'd like to see changed, so we could work together to pursue a gas line. With that, we're going to have a brief at ease while we get ready for the next presenter.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 125 tomorrow on the PERS cost share. We're going to get, we're down to about 45 minutes or so on for ConocoPhillips, so we're going to take care of that issue. We're still needing some copies for the other bills, so with that, we're going to have a presentation from ConocoPhillips on the AGIA. Mr. Brian Wenzel, Vice President, Alaska North Slope Gas Commercialization, and he's already come forward with enthusiasm. He's here. And if you could please introduce yourself, who you represent, and proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the Senate Finance Committee, my name is Brian Wenzel. I'm the Vice President of A&S Gas Development for ConocoPhillips, and I'm based in Anchorage. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to reiterate our views on the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, AGIA, Senate Bill 104 that's before you today. Although ConocoPhillips supports and very much applauds the governor for her efforts to move the gas line project forward, we do not support AGIA as originally introduced. We do not support the CS recently adopted by Senate Judiciary. Rather, we believe that AGIA needs a critical change, a change in approach. AGIA should be changed to allow an applicant to submit an application that achieves AGIA's intent, but does so with a different mix of commitments and terms and conditions. As a potential applicant, we need the ability to propose a comprehensive package, including critical resource terms that I'll talk about here in a moment, that appropriately balances the risks and returns associated with the project while still providing the necessary maximum benefits to Alaska. Now, let me be clear that from ConocoPhillips' standpoint, we very much want to develop our ANS gas resources. If we collectively can find a way with the legislature, with the administration, with the public of Alaska to make this project economic, those gas resources will be developed. But conversely, if our upstream resources, if the terms for development of our upstream gas resources are not sufficient to make the project economic, they won't get developed. We need to find a way to essentially balance the risks, the massive risks associated with this project and the development of those resources with the needs of Alaska. So the real question in my mind, or the real question before us, I believe, is not what does it take to make a gas pipeline happen. Rather, I think the real question before us is how do we make sure that Alaska's gas resources are developed? We believe there's been too much focus on the pipeline and not enough focus on the upstream fiscal terms that are necessary to make the development of those resources economic. We should all be focused on the upstream, on the resource side, where the vast majority of the project risk lies. I think you've had prior testimony, and it's definitely come up before other committees, about the nature of this project and how this project will get presented and put together. And the fact that not only does the geologic risk, to the extent there is any, rest with the upstream, but the upstream infrastructure risk, the price risk, the midstream, the pipeline infrastructure, cost risk lies with the upstream. All of the vast majority of all risks associated with this project, with developing ANS gas resources, will rest with the upstream. We need to understand those upstream fiscal terms such that we can assure ourselves that the project is economic. One way to essentially come to ground on those upstream fiscal terms would be to enter into a dialogue, a discussion around our needs, our objectives, and those of the state. In fact, you've heard not only the producers, but many of the third-party pipeline companies indicate got to solve the upstream resource issues first, then the pipeline project gets much easier. From ConocoPhillips' standpoint, we definitely agree. We believe the best way to resolve these upstream fiscal terms is to sit down and have that dialogue. Now, admittedly, that dialogue, that discussion has been characterized as just another negotiation by the administration, and AGIA is not about negotiation. We understand that. By the same token, the administration has indicated their unwillingness to discuss and adjust the upstream, the resource terms. So it seems this first avenue for resolving the appropriate fiscal structure for the resources is closed. So then we turn to maybe a second alternative to resolve the necessary upstream resource terms, and that would be to essentially ask the business decision makers, those who need to make the investment and develop these resources, to put on the table a comprehensive proposal of what it takes in terms of resource terms and pipeline terms to make this project a reality. Unfortunately, AGIA does not provide that flexibility. AGIA stipulates the exact upstream resource terms in a limited fashion that are available, and again has indicated provides no flexibility for an applicant to propose a different set of resource terms. So again, with the two best methods for resolving this issue, for resolving the necessary changes to the fiscal terms for the resource side, you can appreciate the quandary we're in terms of how to proceed with the project, how to move this forward. And I'll admit at the same time that we have many of the same concerns that you heard presented to you, I think, yesterday by BP around some of the other issues within AGIA. I don't want to discount those, but at the same time, for us, the heart of the issue is how do we get comfortable with the upstream resource terms? The inadequate resource terms stipulated in this piece of legislation causes the uncertainties associated with the project to outweigh the potential returns. And that, in turn, prevents ConocoPhillips from participating in the AGIA process. If AGIA is not changed, we will not be able to make an application under the AGIA process. Now, said more generally, the lack of flexibility in AGIA will prevent ConocoPhillips from making an AGIA application. I also want to address a claim that came up, I guess, just this morning in the paper, where an administration representative suggested the return on this project was in excess of 50%. I have to tell you, from my standpoint, looking at internal project models, I've never seen a return on this project, on this integrated project, anywhere close to 50%. In fact, again, my problem is rather that the returns on the integrated project are closer to zero than they are to 50%. Our problem is the project as described through AGIA is not economically viable. We need different fiscal terms. The claims that the project is wildly economic are simply misleading. This project is not wildly economic. If it were, it would be moving ahead. The claims that it's wildly economic are based on a set of assumptions which no one can guarantee. They're also based on an assumption that a $100 billion plus financial commitment can be ignored when doing your project economics. I would urge you to be very careful about the set of assumptions behind the claims of the economics of this project. At the same time, if anyone can step up and guarantee some of those assumptions, this project's ready to go, no doubt. If we could guarantee gas prices will always be high, capital costs will never increase, gas will be discovered in sufficient quantities to fill this pipeline, this project's ready to go. Those are the very risks that are holding back the project at the moment. Those are the very risks that we as producers, as gas lessees, need to get comfortable with in order to advance this project. So again, from our standpoint, we need to address some of those key risks and try and mitigate those with an upstream resource fiscal package to help us advance the project. That's the easiest way for the state to help mitigate those risks. Now, resource risks have always posed the greatest obstacle to a gas pipeline. Long-term clarity on state taxes and royalties is critically important to reducing those risks. The other thing I wanted to delve into a little bit was our other concerns on AGIA. You may have had the opportunity to hear my colleague Wendy King testify on numerous occasions over the last few weeks on AGIA. She repeatedly indicated, you know, that ConocoPhillips is very concerned with the AGIA process and the overly prescriptive approach. She strongly suggested that a mechanism be introduced into the bill to allow resource lessees to propose alternate resource terms. She's recommended that the committee make amendments to change AGIA's bid requirements to bid variables or broad objectives to provide the flexibility for an applicant to respond to those variables or those objectives in a way that presents the best package proposal. And she's frequently warned about the dangers of the exclusivity provisions that exist within AGIA and the danger that it could hamstring the state's ability to advance the project in the event that a licensee is chosen who can't testimony. Lie numerous issues that concern us within AGIA. There are rigid deadlines. There are requests for initial shippers to subsidize future shippers or subsidize third-party pipeline companies. It requires the waiving our due process rights. It requires parties to accept FERC certifications without the ability to negotiate any conditions on those certs. There's a requirement that makes all project changes to the project subject to state approval and control. And again, most importantly, AGIA is structured, provides inadequate clarity and predictability around resource terms. In the end, all of our suggestions and concerns, recommendations, can be boiled down to a request that AGIA be changed sufficiently that we can submit our best proposal and know that it won't be rejected simply because it doesn't meet all of the exact requirements, the must-haves, the terms and conditions of AGIA. As currently drafted, AGIA would require that a proposal be rejected immediately if it doesn't exactly meet the terms and conditions of AGIA. The administration has indicated that if AGIA process does not produce enough bids or bids of sufficient quality, that they'll repeat the process. We'll start over. Our view is that both we as producers, you as the legislature, the Alaskans, do not have the latitude, can't afford to wait a year to see if we get enough bids or get the right bids. Rather, we should find a way to make the process flexible enough to make sure all bids come in up front. All bids are put on the table and evaluated. We're not suggesting ours will be the only bid. We're suggesting we want our bid on the table. We want it evaluated and considered next to all other bids up front as opposed in some later iteration. We believe that if the AGIA process is truly to allow open and transparent competition, it will allow each applicant to propose a set of work commitments, inducements, terms, and conditions which that applicant believes are best for all stakeholders. In such an arena where AGIA has been changed, we will bid. We will put on the table our best proposal, which we believe best meets the needs of Alaska. Now, in terms of the process forward, I also want to point out that in ConocoPhillips' view, the most efficient, the most expeditious way forward on this project is for ConocoPhillips to work with BP and ExxonMobil to advance this project. We can't ignore the expertise and the knowledge of these three producers. That consortium has, in our view, needs to be the key or the core behind our proposal through AGIA, if and when AGIA is adjusted to allow us to bid. Now, we, at the same time, we've also indicated, not only before various committees, but also to other entities, that we are open to the possibility of including other entities in our consortium bid. To the extent that there are entities out there, be they third-party pipeline companies or other entities, who bring meaningful additions to our proposal to the table, we're happy to include those. You know, for instance, to the extent there are entities who could bring better ways to mitigate risk, better particular assets to the table, cash is always welcome. All of these things, there are other assets that the other entities could bring to the table and provide a meaningful contribution to a joint proposal. In closing, ConocoPhillips very much wants to develop our ANS gas resources. We want to do that by winning the AGIA license and constructing the ANS gas line. We want to participate in this process and truly compete by putting our best proposal on the table for administrative, legislative, and public review. However, in order to get that proposal on the table, and in fact, other creative proposals on the table up front, AGIA needs to be amended.